This episode of Therapy Insiders is brought to you by WebPT, the ultimate EMR for physical therapists. Give them a call at 866-221-1870 for a free demo. Check them out on the web at webpt.com/podcast. And if you're interested in business, we talk about plenty of business on this podcast. You definitely want to check out ascend2015.com, the ultimate rehab therapy business summit. It's going to have some of the biggest, best, brightest names in the field. I'll be there. You definitely want to be there. Check it out. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. Dr. Gene Chirac-Abrod here with Dr. Joe Palmer and Dr. Erson Religioso. How are you guys doing?
Good, Gene.
I'm doing well, Gene.
Well, as long as everyone's doing well. So last episode we talked more about fitness and exercise and a unique business model with Dr. John Russin. And it was very, very cool to hear his perspective on how to create a health wellness with a lifting model. On this episode, we're going to kind of shift gears altogether and look at a topic that we really haven't looked at yet or talked about. And our guest is also unique in that regard, in that she worked at Walter Reed Army Medical Center and saw some very interesting, to use a word, I'm sure we could find other words to describe what she saw, and I'm sure we will. But our guest is Adele Levine, who's a physical therapist from Maryland, our neck of the woods, Joe and I. And Adele, first of all, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
Adele, you worked at Walter Reed, and you worked with amputees mostly, right?
Yes. When I first started working there, I was in the outpatient clinic for about 2.5 years. And then I got switched into the amputee section.
When you made that switch, what were you excited about it? Were you nervous about it? Like, what was your thought process as you go from orthopedics, which is a comfort area for a lot of people, to a whole different world that's more than just physical? There's a big emotional component to it as well.
Wow. Honestly, I mean, I hated it in the beginning. It wasn't my idea to be put in the amputee clinic. And, you know, they would just sort of random. I just got moved in there.
Mostly. When you say hated it, is it you hated the idea of working with amputees?
Well, I guess I was intimidated by it. And I had always felt very comfortable doing orthopedic, outpatient ortho. That's all I'd been doing. And I felt very comfortable doing that. And it was, you know, my happy place.
And, oh, we love happy places, don't we? So,
but I was also getting a little, I guess I was getting a little burnt out working in the outpatient clinic at Walter Reed. And I think our colonel at the time sensed that. So she just pulled me into her office one morning and told me that she was going to be moving me into the amputee section. And in some ways I was excited about it because I had a couple good friends who worked over there. But I was also pretty intimidated because I didn't feel like I was very well prepared.
So you get there, and then what?
So the physical therapists that I worked with, they were fantastic. I mean, everybody really worked as a team. I never felt like I was just sort of thrown into it. And that, I guess, was what I was really worried about was, you know, I was just going to be dropped into the amputee clinic. Good luck. And instead, they kind of eased me into things. But at the same time, things were just so got so hectic so quickly that I sort of felt a little bit I just felt like I was on a. I felt like I was always kind of running around. But it was a very different experience because in the outpatient world, you know, things are very. You know, you see a patient like every half hour or every 45 minutes or however you do it. It's very kind of time regimented, and most patients are. You're only going to see them, you know, once, maybe three times a week for a few weeks. But in the amputee section, we saw our patients every day, and we would see them for months and months and months. In some cases, you would have a patient for a couple of years, depending how bad off they were. So it was a lot to swallow.
So after you transitioned and you kind of go through the fear of the amputee clinic, how long did it take you to find a kind of routine or somewhat of a comfort level, not only being there, but dealing with a completely different mindset of patients? Like you said, they're there for months and months, but you're not just getting them better physically. You have to, in a lot of regards, help them through their challenges emotionally as well. I mean, did you ever even get a comfort zone?
I feel like it was always kind of a roller coaster in there. Because sometimes when you're seeing the same patient every day and it's kind of open-ended and unlimited, you become kind of like, you turn into kind of like this gym teacher persona, which isn't really me.
No whistle?
No, but I mean, that sort of, I like to keep things a little light. And I feel like when you work in the outpatient setting, you can keep things kind of light and chatty. But things could get kind of heavy at Walter Reed. I feel very comfortable now working with an amputee patient. Because I feel like I've kind of seen so many different... I feel like I've gotten like enough tricks up my sleeve now, you know. But it took me a few years to get to that point. And part of the problem that was difficult, and I wasn't the only one who felt this. I mean, my other coworkers and I, we always used to say that we never really felt all that comfortable, was that the injuries kept changing. So we went from seeing, you know, mostly single leg amputees and patients who'd lost their legs below the knees to more and more double and triple amputees. We began to see more and more amputations above the knees and then at the groin and even partial pelvic amputations. By the time Walter Reed closed in 2011, almost every single one of the patients coming in at that point on the medevac were either a double or a triple amputee. And we had rehabilitated three men by that point who had lost all four of their limbs. So there was no way you could really ever get comfortable. By the time we moved to the new Walter Reed at Bethesda, I feel like we had kind of seen the worst of the worst, and then things started to slow down a bit. And I would say that by then, by 2012, 2013, we began to feel fairly comfortable. Although we were still seeing at that point a lot of hip dysarticks, and a lot more hip dysarticks, and also more patients who are losing parts of their pelvis. But by then we kind of knew what to do, I guess.
So the mood daily at the clinic, did you, and I'm referencing this, we haven't mentioned yet, that you wrote a book based on your experiences called Run, Don't Walk. And it chronicled some of the stories, and it had a lively tone. And Erson, in the book, there's a passage and or a phrase that kind of stuck with me. And you said that, and almost like paraphrasing here a little bit, that you had to kind of put a front up, a happy front. Was that a hard thing to always appear lively and happy to in there, or was it always like that? And Ersan, I know you have the book as well, and you read that. Did you, this is to Ersan before, Adele, you can answer that. Ersan, did you get a sense, kind of reading the first several chapters, that putting yourself in that environment, because that's what I did when I was reading the book, I was like, man, how would I do in that environment? And it's just like being happy all the time as a front for the soldiers and people in there, that's got to be exhausting, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I would just say that, yeah, I thought the same thing. And I think as PTs, we have to do that for our patients anyway. It's like you bring your A game no matter what your population is. It's just that I think it would be extra depressing and extra hard on you emotionally. It'd be harder to detach yourself seeing such traumatic injuries. And I mean, I only did, a 6-week internship at a VA, and yeah, it's hard, much less having that be my job. And I only saw, your typical kind of amputations like Adele had seen.
You know, I mean, so it was a happy place in there. And I know that sounds hard to imagine. But actually, our colonel used to call our clinic the happy place because it was. While you were in there, we really kind of celebrated life. And remember, we were working with a lot of very young men, mostly men, women as well, in their early 20s. And, the way they always dealt with stuff was through humor. And that was also kind of, I think, a very physical therapy way of dealing with stuff. I always think that, physical therapists are like the funniest people on the planet. Like, if you want to have a really good happy hour, you go out with a bunch of PTs.
Because they drink a lot.
Well, yeah, they drink a lot and they tell good stories. So it was kind of a raucous, kind of rowdy locker room kind of feel in there. But it did get to you later, for sure. I mean, everybody had their dark days, but we did, we were kind of a fun bunch in there. And I think, I think it started with the patients, and then the therapist definitely picked up on it. I mean, the patients were constantly teasing each other. They would call each other names like Ugly Stump or Princess. If someone was having a hard day, they were a princess. And of course they wore the t-shirts like you mentioned.
Care to share a couple names of the t-shirts?
There was a Marine 50% off. That was a pretty bad one. There was I liked a Stumpy. There was a picture of a handicap sign. Mm-hmm. And underneath it said, I'm just in it for the parking. But, I mean.
there's a couple in the book that I told you some of my favorites. I had a blast in Afghanistan.
Yep.
Marine, some assembly required. So, obviously, they needed to have a sense of humor, but as with any trauma, there's always that underlying depth of hurt that's there, that some, I'm sure, some felt comfortable talking about, some didn't, and they were given the help in different regards. So when did you decide that you wanted to write the book, and what made you want to write the book?
When Walter Reed started to close, that's really when I started to think about it. I had been writing for some time. I'd been writing these kind of like freelance humor articles. And it was mostly kind of like, I'm kind of a project person. I like to have something to do after work. So so I got into writing these short, funny articles about life in D.C. And I was getting a lot of them published in the Post. And a couple of my coworkers at Walter Reed brought up the idea of writing the book. And also my partner, Ashley, she really pushed the point. She kept saying it for years that I should do that. And I thought it was a bad idea, because the whole reason I was writing was to kind of take my mind off of work. So I didn't really think it would be a really good idea to write about work. But when Walter Reed started to shut down, and Walter Reed was America's oldest military hospital. It was open for 102 years.
Wow, I didn't know that.
No, I mean, it had it was a real, I really felt like, I was sad to realize we were kind of its last chapter. So Walter Reed treated soldiers from every single war America fought in, from World War II forward. So,
wow.
Yeah, so when you had this real sense of history when you were there, when you'd walk through the original hospital, they had these stone steps that you would go up, and the steps, to me, they always seemed like they sort of sagged in the middle, but they were just so worn out from, you know, 100 years of footsteps. I just thought it was an incredible place. It was, so there was a lot of history there. There was a lot of pride. A lot of people were really, there was this feeling there that just wasn't recreated at the new Walter Reed. And I just felt like I wanted to kind of capture what we went through. The other reason when I thought about writing the book is, I guess a lot of people don't realize this, but we worked in a glassed-in rehab clinic.
The fishbowl.
Yeah, I called it the fishbowl just in my head. But it's known as the MATSE, the Military Advanced Training Center. But
I like
it was,
the fishbowl more.
Yeah, so me too. Our patients and my coworkers used to call it, well, they always used to say, oh, this is how it must feel like to be an animal in the zoo. Because we were in this glassed-in cage, kind of fishbowl, and they would lead tour groups around the perimeter. So you're always looking up at someone looking in at you, and it was just like this weird feeling, and I just really wanted to kind of bring people into our side of the aquarium, you know?
don't feed the animals, or?
Yeah, exactly. We used to say that all the time. But it was a real sense of us versus them. So on the outside, you know, all the tour groups, they always looked kind of horrified and upset, you know, and maybe you guys are a little horrified. But on our side of the glass, you know, everybody was always joking and laughing because we had just sort of gotten used to it. It was like a normal day for all of us. So I just really wanted to capture that. I thought it was a special place. And my coworkers always used to say, you know, you just can't make this stuff up.
So a lot of people, I'm sure, feel that way in the clinic, you know, with patients coming through and the stories that we hear. You know, life, a lot of times you don't have to make up the stories to make it entertaining. But not everybody writes a book. And so anybody that's listening that has written blog posts or does blogging, Urson included, know that it's not an easy thing to create original content. How was that process? I'm curious because I don't know that many authors, but how was sitting down, writing the pages, editing, trying to get it published? You're on Amazon, obviously. It looks like you have good reviews on Amazon. It's an entertaining book. I think you told me before it was like a mixture of Scrubs with something else, which got me intrigued because Scrubs is one of my favorite medical shows of all time. And it is. It's kind of like a funny, lively read, but has that depth to it that as you're reading, you find the humor, but you just still feel the gravitas of it. So how was that process for you? How many revisions did it have to go through? Were you like driving yourself crazy, or did it just come smoothly? You just sat down. It was like blah, 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 all out there.
I made everybody crazy around me for about 3.5 years. I mean, I was a nightmare. So it was hard. I have never written a book before. All I'd been doing was writing these short 750-word articles. But like I said, I'm kind of a project person. So once I get into something, you know, I just go full speed. What was frustrating for me was that I thought, oh, I'll knock this off in 6 months. Instead, I was just, you know, I probably did about 15 revisions of the manuscript.
That's it?
Oh, yeah. it was a slog. And I didn't really know how to put it together. And I would think I was done. And then I'd read it the next day. You know, you have all these ups and downs. You think you wrote something fantastic. And then the next morning when you read it, you're completely dismayed. You think it's terrible, the worst thing you've ever written. But I just kept at it. I got up around 4:30 in the morning, and I would write before going into work. I would write in the evenings, on the weekends. I mean, I just was obsessed. And as far as getting it published, that was extremely, I mean, the publishing process is a glacier pace. And I'm a very kind of time-oriented person, and that was a frustrating piece for me. But you have to, I had to find an agent, and I queried a lot of agents. I got a lot of rejections. I fired an agent and got a new agent. And
why'd you fire an agent?
I felt like, well, she wanted to take Walter Reed out of the storyline. Really? She didn't feel like the, yeah, and I feel like Walter.
Oh, why don't you just take a patient out too?
Yeah, yeah. So I just didn't, and there were a few other things too. But she started to feel to me like kind of like one of the mean girls in high school, and I just decided I didn't. She just didn't have. I don't know a better way to say this. She just didn't have any balls. I was like, you know what? A lot of agents don't want to take a chance on a new writer. And if they do, they want it to be completely perfect. So I found a new agent. And he was much more ballsy, kind of. And he sent me up to New York. I interviewed with all the major publishers. I interviewed with Random House and Penguin and William and Morrow. St. Martin's Press, and two publishing houses bid on my book. So for a new writer, it was, you know, I was really grateful to have, you know, that kind of reception. So once I got a publisher, things really sped along at that point. I sold my book kind of on a proposal basis, and I spent a year really writing it under a deadline to get it ready.
That's pretty cool.
But, yeah.
What setting are you in now? Because I only read like the first 3 or 4 chapters, so I don't know exactly where you are at this point in your career.
Spoiler alert.
I'm not at Walter Reed anymore. I left last
year. Well, yeah,
year.
I figured that because it's closed, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Walter Reed closed. There was a it was a BRAC closure, which is kind of like the Base Realignment and Closure Committee meets like, I don't know, every few years, and they go through all these military bases and they decide which ones, you know, they should maybe shut down to save money. And Walter Reed, Bethesda Naval, and Fort Belvoir are 3 medical facilities all within like 11 miles of each other. And especially Walter Reed and Bethesda Naval were 7 miles apart. So they decided that one of them should be shut down. This was way before things got really hot over in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they decided to shut Walter Reed down and merge us with Bethesda Naval. So they built us a new hospital over at Bethesda Naval, and they renamed it Walter Reed. But it's definitely not the same as the Walter Reed I was at. But I did transfer over to the new Walter Reed, so I spent about nine years working at Walter Reed Army Medical Center and then later Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. But I left. I left, and I had a friend who was doing kind of her own sort of private practice where she was seeing Medicare B patients in their homes. And she was moving, and she needed someone to take over her patients. And so I started doing that and pretty much drove that right into the ground. But I'm kidding. But it was – I just got lonely.
I'm kidding, but seriously.
PTs out there for themselves, but I really need to be in kind of a bigger setting. So I'm doing PRN at 2 different hospitals, and I'm doing inpatient work, which I never really have done much inpatient stuff before. And so it's like a brand new world for me. It's a new frontier. So I can't say that it's not my favorite thing to do, but I kind of enjoy it right now.
So you mean you're not making millions and millions of dollars off your book?
You don't make money writing.
That's what I keep hearing.
Yeah.
Just selling.
If it were a New York Times bestseller, for sure. But do you know there's a new book on Amazon every 5 minutes?
No, I didn't know that. So what you need to do is get it picked up as a TV show.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just glad it's out there. I just wanted to have kind of a sort of like a memory book.
It's a little bit more than that.
Yeah, but yeah, spread the word. Feel free.
Done.
This episode of Therapy Insiders is sponsored by WebPT, as we mentioned, the ultimate EMR for physical therapists. But what makes them the ultimate EMR, I'm sure you're wondering. I decided to ask Anne, a longtime user of WebPT. Here's what she had to say.
I really like the fact that I can send my notes right through WebPT. I can fax them to physicians so that they can see the plan of care and sign it and send it back. My logo is on everything that I send out, and it's all legible. So it really saves me a lot of time in the end because I don't have calls back from either insurance companies or attorneys if it's, you know, a car accident, things like that, asking me to interpret my handwriting on anything.
WebPT, the ultimate EMR for physical therapists, because it's more than just notes. Check them out at 866-221-1870 for a free demo or webpt.com/podcast.
You know, I thought the whole reason I wanted to do this PRN gig and also the other work for myself thing was I thought I would be able to spend more time writing. You know, because I always sort of wanted to be a writer. And when I actually did become a writer, I realized that I really define myself as a physical therapist more. You know, I don't call myself an author. I call myself a physical therapist. So I really missed being around other PTs during my little, work for myself gig. So I have been writing. I mean, I've had a few articles come out since I wrote the book. I mean, more than a few, but I guess I've spent most of my time working on building a garden shed. So
is that metaphorical or an actual garden shed?
No, it really is. I tell you, it's like all my neighbors have been out watching this project. So, but it's still standing. I work on it every day. I can send you a picture.
Please do. So is it taking as many revisions as your book? A three-year process with 15 revisions of the shed?
I thought it would take me months and took me a few weeks. So it looks pretty good. Now I need to do the inside. So
get on it. All right, so we have a few questions on Twitter coming at you. The first one from Stand Haiti Project, at Stand Haiti. So lots of psychosocial issues working with amputees, especially the traumatic and young. Any words of advice, suggestions on how you deal with or integrate the psychosocial with the bio?
Well, one thing that I think gets under everyone's skin, at least over at Walter Reed with our patients, is everybody coming up to them and being like, hey, dude, like, so what happened? You know, like, tell me your story. Like, they hate that. Everybody thinks they're doing them a big favor by allowing them to talk about what happened to themselves. You know, nobody likes that. I think that's the first place to go. Like, I tried to stay away from asking them to repeat the very worst day of their life to me. You know, like, would you do that? Like, in another circumstance to someone else you never knew? Like, I just feel like you should be respectful and treat someone just, you know, like, I always kept things kind of light. Like, I just always like to know where they were from and what they were into. And then if I feel like that's a better way to gain someone's trust than to force them to tell you, you know, all about their injury. Then let me tell you, that happens to them like 25 times a day.
So you have to empathize with them instead of sympathizing, which I think is a trait of a good clinician, regardless whether you're working with amputees or you're working with somebody that's been dealing with pain for a long time. Most people don't really want you to feel bad for them. They just want you to understand what they're going through and have that level of connection to go to not go, oh, hey, you know, what happened to you? Or, you know, does that hurt? Or instead of saying, yeah, okay, you know, I see that this happened to you. I personally can't relate to it, but because I haven't lived through it, but I'm sure that that sucks on a lot of levels. So what can I do to help you type of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it the best is, you know, people don't want you to feel sorry for them. You know, people can pick up on that pretty quickly, and they feel like you're being patronizing. So I just wouldn't go there. I think Jim was a great character in my book because he was all about himself. He was one of the PTs I worked with. And as soon as he met a new patient, he would immediately launch into telling them all about him. You know, the latest cake recipe he made, what he was doing last night, what restaurant he went to. And, you know, the patients, once they got over being kind of weirded out by Jim, they just loved him. So because he made them feel totally normal. You know, he
took their mind off it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I always feel like I'm, you know, I'm not the best counselor, but I just feel like I can be kind of real with my patients. And as far as, you know, being, as far as the psychosocial question, you know, I'm definitely not a psychologist or, you know, it's definitely not one of my skills, but I think I'm just a nice person, and maybe that's the best way to go about it.
But they were also getting psychological evaluation as well, right, Adele? Like,
you know,
multi-specialty.
So there's a big, you know, they should, and a lot of the patients though didn't want to talk to the psychologists, even though they probably would have benefited. We probably would have benefited too. There was a nice a psychologist who started hanging out in our clinic, and he was very approachable. And I thought his manner was really good. But for the most part, the patients were afraid of the psychologist, because in the military, if you get a Section 8, if you if they categorize you as having a psychological disorder, you can actually lose your military retirement.
Wow. Really?
Really?
Well, you won't lose it if you got like PTSD or something like that happened while you're in the military, you won't. But if for some reason they found out that maybe you're schizophrenic and lied about that, and you know, when they ask you on the intake forms, you know, before you come into the service, if they find out later that you are schizophrenic and lied about it, then you could lose your medical retirement. At least that's what I've heard. I'm not in the military, so I could be wrong, but that's how it was explained to me.
You're not in the military, but you wrote a book, so we take your word for it.
Oh, okay, but you know, lots of people write books, and they can be told, you know, there are a lot of books out there that are dead wrong, but I would like to say that, you know, I feel like I wrote about something that I felt very comfortable talking about.
Well, you wrote a book and you're an author, so you're the authority on the topic. You know, that's the story, okay? We're sticking with that.
But you know who was really great in our clinic as far as counseling the soldiers, and that we also saw Marines and Airmen and Navy SEALs, what was the chaplain. You know, the chaplain was just hands down fantastic. So he was just very approachable. And, you know, where the soldiers didn't feel comfortable talking to the psychologist because they were worried, you know, about what might happen if it got in their medical record, they felt very comfortable talking to the chaplain. And also he was just like, you know, the chaplain is in bed with the troops. And, you know, we had two really good chaplains my time there. And they had both of them had deployed. So I think that's one way that that they do receive counseling.
Did you ever find that the soldiers, because you're obviously working with a younger population, very motivated, I know I work with a few soldiers, but no amputees. Do you find that regardless of the loss of limb or the trauma that they went through, there's really no second thoughts? There's no, they don't really have any issue with if they could get something to jump right back in. I mean, their mindset, I feel like their resolve is incredible, even through some trauma. Did you see that, or did you see kind of the cracks in the armor, so to speak?
You know, you see everything over there. I mean, just because we were working with young people doesn't mean that they were super motivated. But everybody says that, and I think that's kind of funny, because I find that sometimes working with older people, they're much more motivated because they're worried that they're going to end up in a nursing home. So when you're working with a 20-year-old guy, you know, he's not that. He'd rather be playing Xbox. He doesn't want to come to PT. I mean, I'm making some generalizations, but we had the whole gamut. We had some guys who were super motivated and would be in the PT clinic seriously like 6 or 7 hours a day. And then we actually had to like chase them out of there. And then we had other guys who never came in, and they would have to be escorted into the PT clinic by their, you know, by their sergeants. So there was the whole gamut. The nice thing, though, was that we were working with people who were really in the prime of their lives. So they were in fantastic physical shape outside of their amputations. So you weren't dealing with diabetes and heart disease and all this other stuff on top of an amputation. You're working with a really healthy individual. So they could tolerate just about everything we threw at them if they were interested in doing that.
And I'm sure you were literally throwing things at them at some point. Yeah, I mean, that you're right. That's a fairly big generalization, because you're assuming that 20-year-old is playing Xbox and not PlayStation. So,
yes, you're right.
be careful with your generalizations, yes, okay, yes. Adele? So another Twitter question for you from Dan Crusoe at Dan Crusoe DPT. So Dan asked two questions. We'll start with, personally, what was the most challenging aspect of your job during the time at Walter Reed?
Oh, it was the hours. I mean, we supposedly we started at 7, but you know, in military time, you always start 15 minutes earlier. So, you know, we really were expected to be ready to go at 6:45, but you know, in order to find parking, you know, you had to get there maybe 6:15. So I felt like I was in a different time zone. And some of my coworkers would do like crazy stuff, like get there at 4:30 in the morning so they could go running or something first. So if we had like a happy hour, it would be at 4 o'clock, and then everyone is lights out at 9. I mean, if you want to go to war against this country, I always felt like the best time would be like 10:30 at night when everybody's like fast asleep.
But let's keep that hush. We don't want secrets like that getting out.
Yeah, so I mean, I certainly wouldn't be doing anything crazy like talking to someone on Skype at 9:30 at night. But I feel like I just so the hours were tough. And we also, when we were in the last few years at Walter Reed, and we were seeing between 100 and 150 amputees a day in our clinic, and it was just so busy that we were getting to work at 6, and we were working through lunch, and we were staying late, and I just sort of felt like I was on this treadmill that wouldn't stop. And then at night, you know, you're going to bed early because you're worried you have to get up so early. I remember being in bed one night and just feeling like there was this clamp on my head. I just felt like someone was tightening the clamp. But yeah, it was a tough time for a few years.
Wow. Sounds like you put yourself completely into it. And I think that when you do that, you really are able to make a difference. And so Dan also wanted to know what your one most rewarding moment was working with a military population.
Gosh, there were so many. I mean, I'm scrolling frantically through 9 years of work. I mean, there were so many nice moments. A lot of our patients would come back to visit after they'd been discharged and they'd gone home. A lot of times they would come back with their fiance in tow, or they'd come back with their baby. So, I mean, those are really the highlights, you know, when they would come back. Those are the nicest times.
And that's the times when you really get to see the difference that you've made in their lives, right? You get to see them continuing to live and be successful. And that's why we all do it, right?
Oh, totally. And also, I just feel like really proud for them, because I think, you know, they had a lot handed to them, you know, to be so young and to have such a, you know, devastating injury, and to also at the same time kind of lose your path in life, because a lot of them would have great difficulty continuing in the military career in the way they would want to. So it was hard to see, you know, young people struggle with that sort of part of their life. But they all kind of made it through the other side. Many of them did. And so that was nice to see. And I like, you know, I keep in touch with a lot of my patients, and it's just, I'm just happy for them to see them, you know, moving on with their lives.
I always wonder with all the movies, obviously with the military and injuries, you know, my wife and I watched American Sniper a few weeks ago, and, obviously, there's some stylization and drama added into it, but I know someone that was friends with Chris Kyle, and he would go hunting with him, and he's really close friends with his wife now, and he would tell me, you know, some of the stuff that Chris would tell him about, and some of the stuff in the movie that was real but was a little bit more, obviously, Hollywoodized, but some of the pieces, like when he would go to do some counseling with some of the guys after they were in battle or had wounds, you know, you always wonder whether it's real or it's not real. Like, you really don't know the trauma that people go through, but more importantly, when they're taken away from what they've been training for so long, in the military, then all of a sudden they get injured like this, and their new life is rehab. And then when rehab is over, what did they have? Like, where did they go? What did they do? And I know that's a really big issue that a lot of them face. And to me, that would be a really hard thing to see and deal with when you see these kids essentially for months and months, and then a lot of them, like, where do they have somewhere to go? Do they have something to do? Was that hard for you? Did you see that? Or do you try to really separate yourself from that so it doesn't wear you down personally?
You know, I think my coworkers and I, we all kind of jumped on them all the time about, what are you going to do now? Like, a lot of our patients ended up, not a lot, but there were a few who stayed in the area. And then there were a few we had to kind of push out of the nest in a way. We used to accuse some of our patients of becoming institutionalized. Although looking back on it, I would say that the person who really got institutionalized was probably me. Because I had such a hard time leaving Walter Reed, because I was, I don't know, going to miss my bike ride to work and the defect chicken. But
defect chicken?
The dining facility chicken.
Ah.
So, but yeah, our patients, I think that was the hardest part. We used to say there was like a 99% breakup rate in our clinic. Like, a lot of the patients, they married young and then they had these bad injuries, and then like their wife would leave them. And it was just, you just feel so bad for these guys. You know, watching them go through that. And also, a lot of them, you know, they loved being in the military, but especially they loved being in the infantry. And the military was great. They said they could stay in, they would find them, you know, a job they could do. But a lot of them left because what they really loved was being on the ground. And when they couldn't do that anymore, then they didn't really know what to do. So they, you know, it was hard because they, at least in our clinic, they had each other. You know, they were surrounded by, you know, 100 other guys just like them going through the same thing. But a lot of them would tell us when they come back to visit that sometimes they had some dark days when they went back home.
Yeah, I can believe that. You created a new ecosystem for them, a new comfort zone that eventually would become a comfort zone, a new regular, a new routine, a new steady. So let me ask you one final question. If you close your eyes right now, what memory would pop into your head about your time at Walter Reed?
Oh, just the being inside our little fishbowl. You know, my coworkers and I would get there around a little after 6 in the morning, and we'd all have breakfast together. And then, you know, the morning patients who came in, they were usually the liveliest ones. There were so many nice moments. I was there for 9 years. We saw 150 patients a day. It was one thing I liked was the patients used to joke that they had to call down in advance to reserve a mat table, which I just always loved that comment.
Hey, Gene, can you do that with Medicare rules? Can you see 150 patients a day?
I could, but I would only get paid for 5.
Oh, but yeah, I mean, it wasn't just.
I'm just kidding. Government payer, though, right?
If I saw 150 patients in a day, I probably would not come home.
I mean, we used to joke that there was like a line of people in front of the treadmill. I mean, it was just the last couple of years when things were so busy over there.
Wow.
Yeah, that's intense.
So is the facility bigger where it is now?
No, it's smaller. It's a little, but you know what? I mean, things have just slowed down so much. So, you know, I went from seeing 3 to 5 patients at a time to 3 to 5 patients a day my last year at Bethesda. And that's when I decided, you know, I probably should move on. That's when I started thinking I'm getting really institutionalized because we weren't doing a whole lot, but at the same time, I was afraid to leave because I felt comfortable where I was. I finally felt comfortable where I was. So I forced myself to kind of leave and get out of my comfort zone. But I just don't think it's good. It's not good to be so busy that you feel like there's a clamp on your head getting tighter and tighter. But it's also not good just to be standing around and like scanning the medevac list looking for a new amputee. Like that is when it's time to go. So, but the good news is that, you know, we just aren't seeing those kind of injuries anymore.
That is good news. That is good news.
I hope it continues.
Agreed. So thanks so much for joining us. I mean, I thought that was incredible to hear that. And there's so much more in your book, Run, Don't Walk, which is available on Amazon. If our listeners are interested in seeing some of your articles or some of your writings or where they could find you, where would you direct them?
Oh, I have a webpage. It's easy. It's just my name, .com, AdeleLevine.com. Or if you go to PT Adele, there should be a link.
So at PT Adele on Twitter, and we'll put all your stuff on our website.
Oh, thank you.
TherapyInsiders.com. Any closing thoughts, Adele? Anything you want to share, finish out with?
No, I just, you know, I'm just really proud to be a physical therapist. I think, you know, no matter who you work with or where you work, you know, every day when you go in, you're doing something that really matters. I don't think people should discount who they work with. You know, whoever you're working with, even if you're seeing someone who just sprained their pinky toe, you know, it's a big deal for them. even though it might not seem like a big deal to you. So you're making a difference.
That's right. Don't judge the pinky toe.
Yeah, exactly.
What about you, Joe? Any closing thoughts?
Yeah. I'm just encourage all of our listeners to thank a veteran. You don't have to wait till Veterans Day to do that. And I think hearing some of Adele's experiences, that's what I take away. These guys and gals, they sacrifice a lot, and I think that we can't thank them enough for what they do for us.
Absolutely. And thank them in the right way, as Adele said. Don't necessarily poke and prod about what happened to them. Just treat them as you would treat anybody else. Tell them thank you, and take them out to lunch, take them out to dinner, and do normal stuff, and let them talk. Let them be them. And
or ask them how big the shark was that bit their leg off. They would like that.
don't pussyfoot around the topic and just be. So that's. But most of them have pretty good senses of humor, and most of them are pretty open to talking once they realize they're not being babied or handled with kid gloves, but also not poking and prodding. So the mastering the conversation, which I think a lot of us are somewhat good at, but there's always room for improvement that we've talked about, the lost art of communication. So Adele, again, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll post all your stuff on our website, Therapy Insiders. Again, thank you to all our listeners for participating on Twitter and sending us the comments. We love getting the conversations going after these podcasts and talking about topics. So our project, hashtag Project PT for you guys this week, like Joe said, if you know of any veterans or you don't, reach out, say thank you, buy someone some lunch, and ask them about the shark that bit them, if there was one. So catch us on iTunes if you haven't left us a review yet. What the hell are you waiting for? Go on iTunes and leave us a review and a rating. Helps us out a lot. And catch us on Twitter at Therapy Insiders, at Joe DPT, at the OMPT, and again, Adele at PT Adele. So thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.